The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Music Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alexis Petridis and I'm back from the cold. Coming up in this week's podcast...
For the people in the cheaper seats, clap your hands. And the rest of you, if you just rattle your jewellery. There are places I remember
all my life, though some have changed. In this royal variety show when you're appearing before royalty, Teddy's saying that he couldn't distinguish...
I can't stand Teddy saying that at all, really. I'm not going to vote for Ted.
And you think you're so clever and classless and free, but you're still fucking peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be.
On the 30th anniversary of his death, the programme concentrates on some unexpected aspects of John Lennon's life. We hear how his influence on the direction of music on TV shouldn't be underestimated.
We're going to stay in bed for 7 days, sort of, instead of having a private honeymoon. It's a private protest.
For the violence that's going in the world. Let's stay in bed for the spring.
And grow your hair.
We reappraise and re-listen to some of the music of his companion and collaborator, Yoko Ono.
I read the news today, oh boy.
Late this evening, one of the world's great entertainers and musicians, John Lennon of the Beatles, were shot outside his New York home.
And Rosie Swash and John Harris join me to pick out our favourite tracks. That's all in this week's Music Weekly. Welcome to the programme. I made it in this week. Brighton is no longer like the Arctic, and something approaching a regular train timetable has been resumed. So here I am, as usual, joined by Rosie Swash. Hello, Rosie.
Hello, Alexis.
How are you doing?
You're
all
right? Very well, thank you.
Excellent. Did you manage without me, I suppose?
Yeah, just about.
And also in the pod with us this week is John Harris. Hello.
Hello.
It's the first time on the Guardian
it
podcast.
It is. I'm honoured.
Well, this week was the 30th anniversary of the death of John Lennon. If he had not been shot outside his apartment in the Dakota Building on 72nd Street in New York on December the 8th, 1980, Lennon would have turned 70 earlier this year. In this programme, we'll hear a couple of seldom considered aspects of his life. Later, we'll discuss the musical career of his wife Yoko Ono, which flourished, obviously, with his collaboration. But we start with Lennon's unexpected influence in shaping how music was broadcast on television, something I didn't know about at all. Regular listeners will have heard the enormously genial film director Tony Palmer in conversation with Rosie last month, talking about his Leonard Cohen film Bird on Wire. But he went on to reveal to us how John Lennon persuaded him into revolutionising music TV in the UK. Explain yourself, please, Rosie.
Yes, the series is All You Need Is Love, which I think we've talked about a little bit on the show before. We're both big fans, right? We talked about it before. It's 17 hours long or something ridiculous like that. I would thoroughly recommend getting the box set. And I didn't know, I knew that there was an involvement of John Lennon, but I had no idea quite how influential he'd been in actually getting it made and also inspiring Tony Palmer to make it.
There's also a documentary before that, though, isn't there? There's All My Loving, which I know came out in 1968 and was considered so shocking by the BBC. Yeah. They sort of broadcast it. They didn't tell anybody they were putting it on, and they just broadcast it after the close down with no publicity whatsoever. So on the off chance that you were like ahead, who happened to be sitting in front of the telly, you know, in some kind of altered state, watching the close down, you would suddenly have been confronted with this kind of probably the first ever serious British music documentary, which has Beatles on it.
And All You Need Is Love has got, you know, it's got Beatles, it's got Stones, it's got that side of it, but it's also got a whole programme about ragtime, which is like a side of music that I've never actually liked.
It's on Sky Arts about 6 months ago.
And it's going to be back on the BBC next year, apparently, Tony Palmer tells me. But when I went to meet him in his house in Ealing, I asked him to tell me what happened when he first met John Lennon.
When I was at university, Cambridge, the Beatles came to give a concert. It's sort of 63-ish. And there was a press conference. And I went along as representing the university newspaper and was supposed to write an article about this. And after the press conference, everybody's milling about, and I am tapped on the shoulder by one John Lennon, who said, "Why didn't you ask any questions?" And I said, because I thought it was pretty silly. And he said, "It was really, wasn't it? What do you do? I'm a student. What of?" And I told him. And he said, "Would I show him round the university?" And I said, "No, why not? Well, we'll be mobbed, and that's not my idea of fun." So he said, "How about if I turn up?" The press conference was in the morning. How about if I turn up in disguise?" Him, Lennon. And I said, "Okay." So I arranged to meet him at the hotel they were staying at, 2 o'clock, and there was John Lennon with a very long, silly beard, an even sillier big hat, and a brown raincoat. So, I mean, we just both got hysterically. I mean, we just fell around. So we got rid of that. And I did, Matt, I took him to King's College Chapel, took him to the Wren Library, one or two other places. And at the end, he said, "Call me when you come to London." And I said, "Hang on, I'm going to be at university for quite a few more years, I hope." So now we go on. I now do come to London and join the BBC. So I telephone the number. By this time, of course, we're talking about 1966 now. I mean, they are intergalactic. Sergeant Pepper wasn't there yet, but I think Rubber Soul had just come out. But I could tell from listening to this girl that I was the 400th person that had rung up that morning and said, "John Lennon said to call." Mm. "Oh, yes," she said, "oh, another one." And anyway, I think about an hour later, a man called Derek Taylor, who was their publicist, rang up and said, "I have a message for you." And I was thinking it's F off or something. And he said, "John wants to know why it's taken you 3 years to call him." So the following day, heavy lunch with brown rice. And and I was reminded of this relentlessly, you see. "Why have you taken 3 years? What's the matter with you? What did I do wrong?" And all that went on. It was a wonderful conversation. But he then came to the point, which was the reason we were having lunch. And he said, "You know, pop music on the BBC is in a terrible state." "Yes, why?" "Well," he said, "there are all kinds of wonderful musicians who simply can't get on television or don't want to be on television because they don't want to appear behind gyrating nubiles." And, well, I mean, one is always in favour of gyrating nubiles, but, you know, you can see from Jimi Hendrix's point of view, this is not a terribly good idea.
"I can't express myself in a, you know, conversation. I can't explain myself like this or that sometimes because, you know, this doesn't come out like that. So, excuse me, who on stage, it's all in the world. That's your whole life.
Or you've got to do the 3-minute number, you see, and try telling Eric Clapton, stick to 3 minutes, Eric, otherwise you're off." And in those days, of course, all there was Top of the Pops or Jukebox Jury. So John had a point, I mean, a major point. And so I said, "Well, what do you want to do about this?" And he said, "You are going to do something about this. You are now the BBC. You have infiltrated the enemy," as he put it. He said, "We've got to do something." And so I said, "Well, give me the list." And it is extraordinary now when I think about it, but the list he gave me, it was the case that they had either never appeared on television or not in any satisfactory way that pleased them. Hendrix, we just mentioned. Cream, we just mentioned. The Animals, I mean, at their most rampant, not, you know, doing pretty little songs. Frank Zappa and the Mother's Invention. And the Who smashing up their equipment. So I said, "Well, I don't know these people." So John said, "Listen, I will make the introductions. I will make sure they do it. But you've got to make the film." Now, I had then made one film on my own, which was a film about Benjamin Britten, which by some fluke had become the first BBC film to be networked in the States. So Hugh Weldon, we talked about it, he thought I was the bee's knees. So he said, "What do you want to do now, you see?" So I thought, rock and roll. "Oh, yes, yes, there's a lot of it about," I remember saying. "Well, do something that explains it." So that was a film that we made called All My Loving, which absolutely overnight changed what the public's perception of what rock and roll was on television.
And there are those who demand that pop music is nothing but the grotesque mumblings of a drug-sodden youth. Others, that it is making possible the most startling artistic upheaval since the Renaissance. Others still, that it is merely the harmless entertainment of adolescence. Everyone, however, demands the existence of heroes. Heroes, that is, who can be worshipped, whether they be gods, generals, lone yachtsmen, television personalities, cultural leaders, or pop stars. In this time of instant global communications, these heroes become monsters, who, being semi-myth, seem neither to feel nor care in a way that we're able to understand. Here in Liverpool, in poor homes like these, were born four such heroes, the Beatles, who showed that the best of pop does care, and care with increasing desperation about the way we are and the way we live. Above all, it cares about love.
And I remember about a couple of months later, I'd never ever met him actually. I was at some, it was a BBC party as I recall, and David Jacobs, who was the chairman of Jukebox Jury, came up and he jabbed his finger at me and said, "You ruined my career." And I didn't realise that within a week of All My Loving, they cancelled Jukebox Jury because they realised it had nothing whatsoever to do with what was happening in rock and roll in 1968. In spring of 72, I was in New York doing something completely different. And coming down Fifth Avenue, as I was walking up Fifth Avenue, was one John Lennon. So, brown rice. And what he said was very, again, very interesting. And don't forget, at that point, we had these big series. Kenneth Clark, Civilization, Ascent of Man, Jacob Bronowski, you know, 13-part series. And John said, you know, there's not what you, what we need is something which puts the whole development of popular music into some kind of context. You know, what's the relationship between ragtime and blues? What and where does it come from, and so on? Well, let's make a list. Well, we've got something about ragtime, blues, jazz, swing, and so on. We just made a list, and then he said, "There you are. That's the series." And got up and left. And as he got to the door of this tiny little restaurant where I was, you know, just slightly overdosed on brown rice, he turned around and he said, "Oh, by the way, I've got the perfect title for you." And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Call it All You Need Is Love." So I said, "John, I think that title's been used somewhere." And he said, "It's okay. You use it. I give you permission." So just as they had for All My Loving, which was, again, you know, you use that title.
Well, Liverpool, they used to call it the capital of Ireland. You'd always be around a lot of music.
So I saw him and listened to the tapes, and they were pretty awful, which is, I understood why people had turned them down. But I thought they were interesting, and I thought it was interesting enough to see them.
So he could translate for us and suggest a lot of things, which he did, you know, and he'd come up with amazing technical things like slowing down the piano and playing it slow and putting it on and things like that, you know.
"Something happens on here, you know, I couldn't tell you what, because we have a special man who sits here and goes like this, and the guitar turns into a piano or something." All you need is love, love,
love is all you need. Wow, well, there you go. Who knew? What a peculiar story.
It's sad, isn't it, that he's saying all this about John Lennon helping him change the face of music television, and here we are, however many years later, and music television is once again utterly crap.
Although,
I don't agree with that.
You don't agree with it?
No, all those I watched that Krautrock film the other night, which I'd seen already, actually, on BBC4.
But I mean, that's
all those Britannia films are pretty good.
But anything that all the stuff.
I mean, they're sort of Tony Palmer-esque. Those
excellent, but that's not documenting what's happening now, and that's what he was doing. That's documenting stuff that's already happened.
Yes, I see your point. Yeah,
I'm just trying to think if there's anyone in the contemporary firmament I'd like to watch a documentary about. It'd be about the Arcade Fire, and I'd fall asleep.
And wouldn't you like to see, you know, live music in the way it was done? I don't know, Old Grey Whistle Test.
I miss the tube, but that's because I'm of a certain age. I think
the
idea of an hour and a half or 2 hours of music telly built around live performance on a Friday night.
It seems insane now, doesn't it?
It was just fantastic.
But that's why I think his stuff is so brilliant, is that it was never this, let's move on as quickly as we can. It's not about 3-minute pop songs. He has these enormously long performances within his documentaries, like even Judy Garland singing, which is actually amazing. I would never sit down and watch a Judy Garland's performance on YouTube or something like that, and it's extraordinary. And you just don't get like controllers saying, "Yeah, go on, go and make a 2-hour program."
No, you're dead right.
I
mean,
even
BBC Four things. Anyone who's participated in those will know. I mean, you'll spend 2.5 hours in a club at 10 in the morning in among the empties from last night. It's what always happens. And then they'll cut it down because everything's so jump cut, you know, and you just end up going, "And I didn't know what Oasis were all about."
Yeah,
and that's
it. Yeah,
that's
yeah,
the extent of your 2 hours. Yeah. So the idea of pausing, I mean, that's what amazes you about All You Need Is Love, is when you watch it, after about half an hour, you go, this is different, and I can't quite fathom why. And then you realise that everything breathes in these films.
Yeah. I think it's because music doesn't rate on television, isn't it? I mean, it's a lot of empirical evidence suggests that nobody, if you put a band on, you know, a chat show, everybody switches over. So I guess the idea is that people have no attention span for music whatsoever. So even if you are making whatever, one of those Britannia films, the idea is kind of cram as much information as possible. Although, in fairness, the folk Britannia thing, which is the one that I participated in, it's a three-part documentary about folk music, which is sort of fairly amazing that it exists. However, I think what's intriguing is the sort of climate into which, certainly the first Tony Palmer documentary, All My Loving, rock music hadn't really been intellectualised on any level at that point.
True.
Nobody discussed it in a mean, apart from kind of the odd Times piece about Aeolian cadences or whatever about the Beatles. You know, nobody was, even in 1968, taking rock music seriously enough to...
Don't you think... nobody is now, apart from you.
No, I know, okay.
I mean, I kind of mean that in the sense that... I mean, think of all the hours that are expended on sort of niche music television. I mean, Alexa Chung bouncing around on a sofa asking people what their favourite cheese is. I mean, it has its merits. But again, it's not Tony Palmer.
No.
You know, someone out there should feel as much of a sense of mission as he did back then, actually, now, you know.
But what can it just be showing? I mean, that's what he did. He was showing. He wasn't telling people. He was just, like you said, letting things breathe, letting them their stories tell themselves.
The other problem that you have with a lot of music television is that because music doesn't rate, there's no funding for it.
Yeah.
And so, for example, I mean, I couldn't give you an exact percentage figure, but, you know... Let's say, for argument's sake, 80% of Channel 4's output is funded by record companies. So what you're actually watching is like what used to be called an EPK, an electronic press kit, where you used to get a video of everything. So you get these remarkable programmes. There's one about So Solid Crew, I remember, at the height of So Solid Crew's infamy, that didn't really address any of the issues that So Solid Crew kept going to jail and stuff like that, but started from the premise that So Solid Crew were the most important British band since the Sex Pistols. That was said as a statement of fact at the start of the programme, and got progressively less critical of the band from there on in.
In a less than crowded market, and most of it is from the past, you know. I mean, I luxuriated in an hour and a half of ELO live at Wembley.
Wow.
But Sky Arts is all right. Yeah. I mean, Sky Arts did show Tony Palmer's All You Need Is Love in its entirety. It does show, I mean, it seems to show the Stones in the Park every month, but Stones in the Park every month, but it's those sorts of films, right? And then every now and again, they do a pretty good series. I mean, Will Hodgkinson, who I probably can't mention around here because he works for a rival newspaper, he has this series called Songwriters or something.
Oh, where he goes and interviews like James
Bond. Or he sits down with Mick Hucknall and he says, right, tell us how you wrote this song, tell us how you wrote that song.
Yeah.
And it's pretty interesting. It's all right, you know. A certain sort of football fan watches ESPN Classic, switches it on going, wow, Arsenal versus Sunderland, 1971 FA Cup final. And I sit at home and go, wow, look at that ELO.
They showed, it was BBC 4 showed Queen live in 1975. I think it was like some rock goes to college.
That's good.
It's amazing.
That's Sandra Rhodes pre-vest moustache queen.
But by the same token, it was a very kind of blokey male audience. And for the encore, Freddie Mercury came on in a kimono and sang Hey Big Spender. And just remind me again how nobody thought this man was gay. You just all stood, these guys in great coats stood there, you know. Remarkable insight. And I think actually that's a great thing that you can do on music television now. We've got wildly off the point of John Lennon, but I'm sure he would have been perfectly happy for us to so do.
He'd have watched Freddie Mercury in a kimono.
Oh, he would have loved that.
He really would.
We've cast some light, I think, onto a side of John Lennon that we didn't know about. Who knew that could still be done? We will move on to what John Lennon was famous for, which obviously wasn't television programming. It was his music. We're going to go through our favourite tracks of his. We'll start with John's choice.
Although I laugh and I act like a clown, beneath this mask I am wearing a frown. My tears are falling like rain from the sky. Is it for her or myself that I cry? I'm a
I'm a Loser by the Beatles from 1964's Beatles for Sale. John Harris's choice. John, why did you pick this?
All sorts of reasons. First of all, when people are asked to pick Beatles or John Lennon tracks, it's like the world didn't start till 1965. This is all Oasis's fault.
Yeah.
So nobody talks about the early Beatles at all. And the early Beatles, to my mind, are the sort of very acme of musical excitement. All those songs sound like they go 1,000 miles an hour and they're just brimming with energy. But at the same time, they're tremendously musically inventive. And one of the ways in which they're musically inventive is John Lennon in particular, at a time when rock music was still enthralled to a pretty banal sort of machismo, you know, the curled Elvis lip and all that, sang endlessly about how vulnerable he was. There's loads of songs about crying.
Yeah.
Tons of songs about crying.
There's this sort of real downer side to John Lennon's music, which that and
the But from the start, I mean, on the Beatles' second album with the Beatles, It Won't Be Long, as that line, every night tears run down from my eyes, every day I've done nothing but cry, you know. I mean, this is
a misery on the first Beatles
album.
Yeah,
there's loads of it. And then you see where his career went subsequently, which I think we're coming on to, you know, John Lennon Plastic Ono Band album, when he sort of invents angst rock. Well, it didn't come from nowhere. The point was people missed it. I mean, this is very, very intimate, confessional, cathartic stuff. And Paul McCartney, I was told by Barry Miles, who knows Paul McCartney, Paul McCartney said to him during the Beatles period, you know, John's songs are very personal, you know, I can't really do that. So Paul McCartney would sing much more sort of story songs, Eleanor Rigby and Penny Lane and all those things. But John Lennon, even in his psychedelic period, I mean, you know, the refrain in I'm the Walrus is I'm crying, you know. It was always there. And that song is great. I mean, who'd have thought that this sort of teen idol would write a song called I'm a Loser? Clearly influenced by Bob Dylan, but also because it's on Beatles for Sale. Beatles for Sale is full of the Beatles inventing country rock, which nobody ever talks about. Everybody always says, oh, Graham Parsons invented country rock, and he kind of did. But if you want to find the roots of country rock, Beatles for Sale is full of it. All these sort of Chet Atkins guitar solos, and that's like sounds like a country song. The melody is country and all of that. So on all levels, it showcases that John Lennon was, you know, light years ahead of everybody else, even in 1964.
Rosie, you obviously grew up with Britpop, which, as John says, definitely... If it certainly cemented the Beatles' position, I think, within as this sort of unimpeachable thing within the pantheon of greatness, which definitely didn't exist before. I was told by Mark Ellen that when he tried to put the Beatles on the cover of Q magazine for the 20th anniversary of Sgt. Pepper, there was a huge argument.
It was really weird.
Why don't you put Hue and Cry on
the
cover?
It's really true. When I first came to work for the NME, if you were a Beatles fan or an anorak, as I am, was, you kept it quiet. And when I first met Noel Gallagher... He said, I really like the Beatles, right? This was in 1993. He said, I really like the Beatles. I was like, wow. I thought only that guy from the Boo Radleys liked the Beatles. It's you as well. He says, yeah. I said, have you heard any bootlegs? He goes, no. Oh, he don't like the Beatles that much then. Anyway, so I made him a bootleg tape, and that was like, you know, little samizdat, like they used to call it in the Soviet Union, you know, passing around secret information. So no, it took until a coincidence of circumstance, really. The Gallagher's becoming huge and just talking unendingly about the Beatles, and then the Beatles coming back with Anthology in late 95, and those two things.
And is that because it's like they're such a part of the fabric of our culture? They're just so in it. It's just that people feel that there's nothing new to say about them, there's nothing more to learn.
Why weren't people talking about them pre Britpop?
Yeah, that's
punk rock hangover, probably.
Yeah, there was a sense, I think, up to a certain point, that something might conceivably come along that might be as big as the Beatles. You know, I think even if you look at the sort of music press at the time of how like a band like the Police were discussed, it's like, well, maybe this will go on to be, you know, they're huge, they're really, really big, you know. And I think by the late 80s, it became kind of apparent that this wasn't going to happen. Nothing was going to come along that was going to be as big as the Beatles, which sort of freed people up a little bit. Are you a fan of the early... Well, the question I was going to ask is, are you a fan of the early Beatles?
I've never gone back and reevaluated it in any sense, and it's really interesting to hear John's take on it because it feels like just where they're starting to mature a bit from the earlier period in terms of the songwriting. So I can appreciate, but I don't think this was ever... No, I don't think it was ever the period that really kind of struck a nerve.
Because weirdly, in that era that we're talking about, the Beatles sort of lost fans when they stopped sounding like this and started. So there was definitely this sense that people agreed with Her Majesty the Queen, and when the Beatles have gone awfully strange recently.
That's true. But you know, obviously they became art, and you know, in the minds of the critical fraternity, that always counts for more. But you know, not for nothing when Bob Dylan heard I Want to Hold Your Hand, did he demand the guy stop the car? And I think according to that sort, he just sort of on some hard shoulder somewhere sort of jumps about like little pixie man Bob Dylan jumping around in his Cuban heel boots because he can't believe how exciting it is. And it is really, really exciting. You have to, you know, She Loves You and I Want to Hold Your Hand and all those songs, really, you have to go home, play them in mono, which you can do now,
absolutely,
and turn it up really, really loud. And, you know, most days, to be honest, I'd much rather listen to those records than sort of the interminable art Beatles, you know, like I Want You, She's So Heavy, or While My Guitar Gently Weeps, where it all gets a bit sort of ponderous, you know. Gimme She Loves You and I Want to Hold Your Hand any day of the week.
Okay, well, let's move on to the more ponderous Beatles. This is Rosie's choice.
Just believe in me.
That was God by John Lennon from the 1970 album John Lennon Plastic Ono Band. Rosie's Choice. Tell us why this is angsty, soul searching, drawing, bring the 60s to an end.
I think if I'm honest, probably my favourite song would have been the Ballad of John and Yoko. But I think
rewind my selector.
You know, the only other people who would think that teenage fan club.
I didn't feel I kind of thought you should do something where you've got something to say about it.
Sure.
Kind of singles club. And first time I heard this song, I remember being quite amused by it, I think when I was quite a bit younger, and thinking, oh, you know, he's kind of saying this about Bob Dylan. And then going back to it now, I actually find it really moving. And I think it's probably, you know, I mean, it's definitely been discussed before. What would Lennon be doing now? What would he make of the way he was canonised and that kind of thing? Yeah. And I'm still incredibly fascinated by his relationship with Yoko Ono. I still find it interesting to look at the way that they were together in interviews compared to how she was always represented. You know, she was always represented as this kind of, you know, Japanese ice queen. And actually, when she was with him, she was really coquettish and they were just really in love. And I just love the opening line, God is a concept by which you measure our pain. I just remember going back and listening to that again quite recently and finding that quite bracing. And the dream is over, and just really kind of drumming it in. It's like, forget about the fucking Beatles.
It must have been quite a shocking thing to hear. I think because you know this song exists before you come to it. Do you know what I mean? It's difficult to imagine what it must have sounded like in 1970 in a world where the Beatles were, you know what I mean? I suppose people knew they were breaking up. I suppose they knew, wasn't it? But, you know, it's kind of a kick in the teeth for people.
And also, you know, he always goes back to these kinds of, you know, he's always Christ and crucifixion and, you know, dream is over and God is a concept and all. And I like the way he kind of messed around with that, and it comes up here. And even the way he used to sing about him and Yoko was actually quite biblical. You know, one man, one woman, us against, you know, there was something in that. And I think he did it in an interesting way.
John,
I've got the absolute opposite take on all of this.
Go on.
From Rosie. I mean, I own Plastic Ono Band, the album. It is an important record in the sense that, as I said before, looking back, it kind of does invent angst rock. But a large part of me thinks, well, thanks a lot for that. Because you get Eddie Vedder and, you know, the most awful parts of I'm a Rock Star, I Hear My Pain. Well, no, you know. You've got 24 cans of Hofmeister on your rider and you're going to Philadelphia tomorrow. What's the problem? And I think that about John Lennon, really. Here, I just find this, most of it, lamentably self-indulgent. It's very hard for me to feel moved or affected by it because the experience that he's singing about is so singular, you know. I've not been in the world's most successful rock group. So whereas I'm a Loser, like all great songs, is about something very universal, about being unlucky in love and how that sort of reflects a more deep-seated existential pain. This is so, the whole of this record, and actually Imagine following it, is so specifically about him, you know, Yoko and me, that's reality, and all the rest of it. But I just think it's self-indulgent, and I think in the end, that's what Yoko Ono did. I think while John Lennon was in the Beatles, those, like, in all great partnerships, those more indulgent aspects of himself were held in check, and that applies to Paul McCartney too, you know. But the reason that I think his solo career is pretty awful, most of it, I mean, I wouldn't cross the road to hear Mind Games, the album.
Oh, God, no. There is a period.
Sometime in New York City is a terrible record where he tries to turn himself into a protest singer. Walls and Bridges is the sound of a load of cocaine, really. And Double Fantasy, the album on which he bowed out. I mean, the Yoko stuff's quite interesting, but his stuff on it is pretty awful, so it just sort of leaves me cold. I'd sort of stop at Abbey Road, really. The first run of solo singles is really great.
I actually think the singles keep the quality up, because I think the Mind Games is now is really boring. Mind Games is the song.
Well, then all you need is that album. It used to be called Shave Fish.
Yes, absolutely. I'm somewhere between the two. I do like a lot of John Lennon solo stuff. I would never, you know, if somebody said you've got a choice, you can keep your John Lennon solo albums, you can keep your Beatles albums. It wouldn't take me very long to decide which to get rid of. Going back to the Yoko Ono thing, there is an amazing bit, because I see Yoko Ono's quite a reviled figure. Mm. And there's a great bit in the, I think it's the Imagine documentary, where they're all in the studio recording, and Yoko Ono comes in and starts bossing everyone around and telling them what to do. However, I can't remember what it is she tells them to do, but it actually makes the track loads better. Mm. So there's part of me when she came in was like, oh, God, you know, keep your bitch in control, man, you know. And then she goes, you know, you need to do this, and he needs to, and she's sort of bossing, you know, Klaus Voormann and people like that around. And they start playing it again the way she says, and it sounds loads better. So, you know, big up Yoko Ono.
She used to try that with the Beatles, though, didn't she? And everyone would go quiet and it would all be a bit awkward.
Yeah. And then she took one of George Harrison's chocolate digestives without asking.
It's a huge thing.
It's absolutely true. It's an enormous
round. That's the interesting thing that we need to mention this briefly. This great myth that I had to write this piece for Mojo magazine about Abbey Road. And there's this great myth that the Beatles buried their differences to make Abbey Road in a temporary spirit of the old harmony and all that. And it didn't happen at all. And it was during the Abbey Road sessions that Yoko takes the chocolate biscuit and it all kicks off. Also during Abbey Road, let's not forget that they get a bed from Harrods delivered to Abbey Road.
Yes, absolutely.
And then she lies in bed and they have a microphone trailed over the bed. So she can then say, I think you should turn the bass down. And Paul McCartney goes, who are you again? Sorry.
Yeah, she said she did. There's another thing where she says something. Oh, no, it isn't her. I think it's Jeff Emmerich says something to George Harrison.
That's a good
book.
He
turns around and goes, what?
Have you read his book?
No.
Jeff Emmerich's book. He was the Beatles engineer, yeah. George Martin's right-hand man for non-Beatles anoraks. And he's got a book which you can only get in an American imprint called Here, There and Everywhere. And it's brilliant.
Wow. Finally, this is my choice. Yeah, this is my choice. Have a listen. Everybody's running, and no one makes a move. Well, everybody's a winner, and nothing left to lose. There's a little yellow idol to the north of Kathmandu. Everybody's flying, and no one leaves the ground. Well, everybody's crying, and no one makes a sound. There's a place for us in movies, you just gotta lay around. Nobody Told Me from, it was recorded in 1980, but came out in 1984 on the posthumous Milk and Honey album. The reason I picked that is because I had it on in the office yesterday really loud, and I thought, this is just wicked. This is a really, really good tune. And it's, you know, it's proof that he could still write great stuff. The record I nearly brought in instead of this was Serve Yourself, which is amazing. Anti-Dylan rant from sort of 1979, which he sings this incredibly thick Scouse accent, and it's a sort of two-chord punky thing. But I thought it was a bit obscure for obscure's sake. John, do you have any love in your heart for Latter Day?
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant choice. I really like Nobody Told Me. I had a final copy of Milk and Honey. I thought, I'm not going to spend the full £6 on this or whatever, and I found one in a second-hand shop for £1. So I thought, well, I can't lose. So I bought it, and Nobody Told Me is the standout track. And it's great. One of the reasons it's great, I see, is what you're effectively listening to is a demo, right? Because Nobody Told the Milk and Honey thing, I guess, was meant to get Andy Newmark and the Session guys in, and, you know, Earl Slick and all those people that are on Double Fantasy, and sort of gild it. And it doesn't happen there, so it sounds really raw and what have you. Yeah. I mean, it's like a sort of mono Beatles type of production.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really.
Yeah.
And it's great, and I think the lyrics are great, and it's funny, also quite profound, though, because he's effectively saying that everybody's pretending to live and they're not living at all, you know. So, my malign opinion of John Lennon's solo years is suspended for Nobody Told Me. I mean, you know, this will be said about singles. Every one of those albums has got one or two good things on it. I mean, I like Watching the Wheels on Double Fantasy. I think that's pretty good. I mean, that has all sorts of associations, that whole period, with being 11 years old and a mad Beatles fan when everyone else was in the Adam and the Ants, for which I would be punched at school. And A, it was him and it was the Beatles, so I found that shocking. But also, that was the first time I was aware of somebody really famous who died.
Yeah.
And the world wasn't like it is now, where that would have been inescapable. it sort of happened, and they showed Help on BBC, and it was in the news bulletins and so on, but you had to sort of find out how important it was for yourself.
Mm.
And I think when you're 11, you can just about do that. So I guess that colours why I like that song.
I vaguely remember. I mean, I remember where I was when John Lennon died. I was in the changing rooms at Bradford Grammar School getting ready for a swimming lesson, and we were having a conversation about whether people went to heaven or hell, as you do when you're 9 or whatever. And somebody went, "Where do you think John Lennon's going?" "What, John Lennon's dead?" And I remember my mum being upset about it, which was a peculiar thing coming out of school and saying, "Oh, yeah, John Lennon's died." I remember there being a lot of kind of special editions of the Sunday Times and things like that.
Yeah, but not like there would have been
now. Oh, God, no. Now, no. I mean, there's a thing on The Onion, actually, at the moment, about preparations for Paul McCartney's funeral. It's very funny, a news bulletin. You know, Ringo's going to do a track with Robbie Williams. And, you know, it sort of gives you an insight into how over... I mean, you know, when George Harrison died, it was pretty inescapable for several days, and he was by you know, some stretch.
But all they did on the BBC was they showed Help, the Beatles film, for some reason, which isn't a very good film. They should have shown Hard Day's Night. They showed Help, and then it was sort of on the local news on Granada, as I recall. But it wasn't like it would happen now. I mean, clear the TV schedules. You know, this is all you're going to get, and
live rolling.
You know, it wasn't like Radio 1 played nothing but John Lennon songs for the week after he died. All of those things that would happen. It was very, very.
They did broadcast the silence, though. I remember that from outside the Dakota, the Yoko-sponsored silence.
You see, that's the other thing. You could argue that John Lennon's death was the first stirrings of sort of what we now know as Dianaism.
Yeah, yeah.
Because prior to that, I don't think there'd been all big candlelit vigils and synchronised.
No, I don't think that kind of thing happened when, you know, when Mark Boland died. You know, a question always hangs over: what would John Lennon have done next? And it was answered in fairly terrifying style by Tom Doyle in Mojo, who depicted Lennon in the 80s having a terrible 80s, as everybody from
Everyone
the 60s did, and making albums with like Thomas Dolby producing them and stuff like that. And there'd be some terrible Beatles reunion in 1986, and it would be all really, really embarrassing. Rosie, anyway, yes, are you a fan of this?
Yes, I do. Brilliant song. Agree with John. It's very profound. Has that kind of rites of passage feel to it. Fantastic. Nothing to complain about.
Marvellous. Well, we've just discussed Yoko's involvement with John's music there, but what about the music she made as a solo artist? I am actually quite a supporter of Yoko Ono's solo oeuvre, which I hadn't really heard until it was reissued by Ryko Disc some years ago. There's a sort of complete set of reissues of these albums that she did that are, initially at least, in tandem with John Lennon's albums. There's a Yoko Ono, Plastic Ono Band, and there's Fly, which is sort of obviously meant to be of a piece with Imagine. And there's part of me that thinks, A, that these are kind of undervalued records because of who they were made by, and if they weren't made by Yoko Ono and they were by some weird krautrock band that Julian Cope had dug up from nowhere and went, check this out, people would just go mental, particularly for a lot of stuff on the first two albums. And I think they're worth hearing. Also, there's some really, really mental guitar playing by John Lennon on it, and some incredibly funky drumming by Ringo Starr. Let's listen to a track from Yoko Ono, Plastic Ono Band. This is Why.
Out and I'm getting ready to go out.
Do you?
Yeah.
Is that
No, I don't. No. Actually, sorry.
You have no love in your heart.
No, I've not heard that before.
You don't.
I haven't braved that. I mean, I knew which tracks on those Yoko Ono albums, having sort of read around it.
Mm.
I knew which ones I might quite like, and I've tended to stick with those.
Right.
And it may be some token of my relative to yours conservative tastes that I like the more. Sort of straightforward, rocky ones. So there's a song called Move On Fast, which I think is on Approximately Infinite Universe, which is great. There's one called Sisters Oh Sisters, which is on Sometime in New York City, which is pretty good. I take your point, though, completely about that, which actually is that Sight Unseen, you'd think you were listening to the sort of experimental early 70s German music, shall we say.
Yeah.
That it's very hip to like, and no question, relative to how awful mainstream rock music by the 60s generation got during the 70s. It's commendable that John Lennon and Yoko Ono did that.
No,
but often you want to listen to someone going, is a moot point.
I mean, I don't think the vocal stylings are that different to those of Damo Suzuki. And I think, you know...
Oh, look, no. Come on. You cannot compare. I think Can are in a different place. I really do.
I'm intrigued by the correspondence between Can and these records, actually, because I wonder.
Really?
Morphic
resonance, they call that. Yeah. Two people having the same idea without having had a word with each other.
Donovan making Sunshine Superman at exactly the same time the birds met 8 miles high. There you go. Yes. Anyway, but it's really intriguing because I can't imagine that Can had heard those records, and I can't imagine that. I'd find it really difficult to imagine John Lennon and Yoko Ono sitting around listening to early krautrock. But there seems to be a sort of rhythmic correspondence. There's kind of a Motrick thing going on. There's a bit of a funk thing going on. Let's hear another verse. This is again, I think, sounds a bit like Can. More on the Happy Mondays kind of what Can were doing. This is Mind Train. It's a short extract from the 17-minute-long Mind Train.
instant mea culpa, not instant karma. That does sound like Can.
Yeah, absolutely. Fly is a double album, and you know, with the best will in the world, there are moments on it, like all double albums. You know, in the same way you could jettison Savoy Truffle off the White Album, there are substantial bits of Fly you get rid of. But again, I think it's kind of interesting experimental rock music that doesn't get its due because she was shagging one of the Beatles. And as nobody's saying anything, I'll take it you're all in complete agreement with me about that. The other really weird thing that actually John just touched on is the album after this, which is Approximately Infinite Universe, which she made with Elephant's Memory, the band who play on sometime in New York City. She starts writing songs. And they're actually really... I mean, there's a song on Fly called Mrs. Lennon, which, no doubt about it, Alex Chilton from Big Star totally ripped off for Holocaust off the third Big Star album. It's exactly the same tune. It's exactly the same riff. He's a Beatles obsessive. He would have heard it. This is the opening track we're going to hear next from Approximately Infinite Universe. I think this is just a fucking great song. This is called Yang Yang. Yang Yang from 1972's Approximately Infinite Universe by Yoko Ono. Rosie, how are you feeling about this?
I always feel I have what's the word? Not an affinity with Yoko Ono, but I think she epitomises so many different kinds of prejudice. I mean, I appreciate everything that is said about her role in the Beatles and how irritating that must have been. But if you look back at that period of time and the kind of rock wife, I mean, even now, you know, what is it? It's like, you know, docile, blonde, supportive, quiet, or Anita Pallenberg, or, you know, and she wasn't any of those things. She didn't look like she was supposed to look. She was foreign. The way she's described, it's like, you know, she wasn't prone. She challenged everything. So for that reason, I'm a bit more into the kind of woman power side of Yoko Ono. No, I like that stuff. And to the degree of, I mean, I almost chose this for Singles Club, but I realise it's a little controversial. So I'm just going to warn that I'm going to use the N-word. But when Lennon did Woman as a Nigger of the World, and he sort of said, you know, it was her talking to him about women that opened it up for him. So for that, you know, for feminism, we're like, oh, John snarling.
Of course, I mean, that's sort of by dint of who she was, and not because of what she said, I mean, just the what she represented. And as Alexis is pointing out, by playing this stuff, it's fantastically musically adventurous by any standards, let alone the standards of the time.
And the standards of the rock aristocracy.
But what happened, you know? I mean, the things within this as well, like the bedding and so on, that I just look back on them. John Peel said that the beddings were a complete embarrassment, you know. And what was he meant to do? Sell his television for peace? I mean, this is, you know, it just didn't mean anything. And that thread runs throughout this whole thing, really. And then Yoko Ono now, I mean, they have the John Lennon peace laser beam in Reykjavik or whatever. And then she just, and it's never specific. It's just, oh, you know, we all have to get on and the world can be a better place.
Her Twitter feed, if you've ever been on
that. Oh, man, it's amazing.
Like, what do you mean? And then the other week she was bigging up the Beatles night on X Factor. It's just like, well, you just shut up.
Because whatever John Lennon was doing, if he was still alive, you know what? I reckon he'd agree that X Factor is bad news. So, I so associate her with the creation of the John Lennon heritage industry, which I just find objectionable.
Which is, yeah, and it's completely
I really find it objectionable.
But you know, this
turning his doodles into cartoons and John Lennon glasses and all of that. I can't cope with it, you know.
You know the idea of her, you know, how much control she had over him. What's your take on that? Because I was reading this interview from 1980 with both of them, from Playboy, where... Yeah,
well-known feminist title. Oh, cheers, Yoko. Where
he's saying, oh, he used to send her to meetings as his legal representative and all that, and that he, you know, his line being, people don't listen to what she says because she's a foreign woman, but when she says stuff, she's actually right. But they always say, oh, well done, Lennon. You know, I mean, how much of...
I think she really, really controlled him. And if you read the sort of uncensored, non-hysterical and other accounts of his life with her, particularly in the 70s, in other words... Don't read that Albert Goldman book, because that's obviously a work of dirt digging. But there's a really good book by a fellow called Fred Seaman, who was John Lennon's PA, about, you know, the occasions when they'd get in numerologists. I mean, there are two famous couples in history who've used astrologers and numerologists. One was the Reagans, and the other was the Lennons, right? Yeah. And they get this numerologist in, and this numerologist would say, well, he's got to travel 500 miles on this particular latitude. I don't know anything about geography, but you know, according to the numbers 5, 6, and 5, and the poor sod would have to get in a boat and go off to Bermuda on his own. You know, I mean, I wouldn't stand for it, and that's not going to be an unreconstructed Andy Cat point. I mean, the point is that you would like to think of John Lennon as being an assertive person who knew his own mind, and it seems pretty obvious to me, surveying this period, that actually what happened is pretty simple. He needed a mother figure, right? He blew his mind out with acid and did what you were meant to do according to the diktat of Timothy Leary, which is he lost his ego. And Yoko Ono came along and said, you know what? I'll tell you what to do every second of every day. And he went, all right then. And such was the story of the next 11 years. Sorry, I'm from the north.
My theory...
So are you.
But my wife tells me what to do all the time. So I have more empathy with John Lennon. My other theory about this, going back to the music, about the Yoko Ono stuff, is that there is a sense in which I feel that John Lennon's legacy would be better served if people knew a bit more about these records and a bit more about the weird stuff that he did. And it would actually counteract the John was man of peace kind of, you know what I mean? This kind of bullshit that attached itself to. There's a brilliant piece written in just after his death by Lester Bangs.
There was.
Called Where Were You When John Lennon Died? Where he talks about his reporting about the crowds outside the Dakota building, and he just totally calls bullshit on it and goes, Lennon would have hated this. This is not what he wanted. People standing outside his apartment, holding candles, crying and singing Give Peace a Chance. This was not, you know, he was this sort of acerbic, difficult kind of guy. And I think that side, the sort of, you know, elbows outside of John Lennon comes out as much in these records, which he facilitated and wouldn't have happened without him, and he played on and da-da-da-da, as it does in any of his solo work. And I think it's a nice sort of counterbalance to it. And again, you know, there are times when, you know, that Approximately Infinite Universe is, a counterpart in a way to Sometime in New York City, and it is a better record than the record that John Lennon made at the time. Which brings us to our final track from
Yoko. The Darkness's second album better than Sometime in New York City. I mean, this is not a great
Lieutenant
artistic
Pigeon's,
yardstick.
Pigeon part, yeah. But, you know, it just within, they're never considered as such, is the point that I'm trying to make. And taking that point to its final conclusion, the last track which I'm going to play is Walking on Thin Ice, which was the last track that John Lennon completed. He completed it shortly before he was shot. Actually, on the night he was shot, I think it was last he was in the studio recording this.
Wasn't he holding a copy of it when he was shot, or is that a total... Right. Yeah, is that right?
And again, I just think it's a better record than anything he had done for many years prior to that. Fantastic bit of guitar playing there from Lennon on that. That's Walking on Thin Ice, which is wraps up my attempt at reevaluating the oeuvre of Yoko Ono. Did you like it? Did it make you think any differently about her? Or would you have rather we played Imagine Happy Christmas War is Over and Strawberry Fields Forever? Let us know. Write in. Thank you very much for tuning in, as ever. Thanks to Rosie for being brilliant.
You're welcome.
Thank you to John Harris for coming in. Hope to see you again.
Happy Christmas. War is over.
If you want it.
I don't want it.
Thanks again for coming in. That's all for now. I'm Alexis Petridis. See you next week. Bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.